tickled Grant's ankle, he opened his eyes and saw an enormous beige head. The head tapered to a flat mouth, shaped like the bill of a duck. The eyes, protruding above the flat duck bill, were gentle and soft like a cow's. The duck mouth opened and chewed branches on the limb where Grant was sitting. He saw large, flat teeth in the cheek. The warm lips touched his ankle again as the animal chewed. A duck-billed hadrosaur. He was astonished to see it up close. Not that he was afraid. All the species of duck-billed dinosaurs were herbivorous, and this one acted exactly like a cow. Even though it was huge, its manner was so calm and peaceful, Grant didn't feel threatened. He stayed where he was on the branch, careful not to move, and watched as it ate. The reason Grant was astonished was that he had a proprietary feeling about this animal. It was probably a miasaur from the late Cretaceous in Montana. With John Horner, Grant had been the first to describe the species. Miasaurs had an upcurved lip, which gave them the appearance of smiling. The name meant good mother lizard. Miasaurs were thought to protect their eggs until the babies were born and could take care of themselves. Grant heard an insistent chirping and the big head swung down. He moved just enough to see the baby hadrosaur scampering around the feet of the adult. The baby was dark beige with black spots. The adult bent her head low to the ground and waited, unmoving, while the baby stood up on its hind legs, resting its front legs on the mother's jaw, and ate the branches that protruded from the side of the mother's mouth. The mother waited patiently until the baby had finished eating and dropped back down to all fours again. Then the big head came back up toward Grant. The hadrosaur continued to eat, just a few feet from him. Grant looked at the two elongated air holes on top of the flat upper bill. Apparently the dinosaur couldn't smell Grant. And even though the left eye was looking right at him, for some reason the hadrosaur didn't react to him. He remembered how the tyrannosaur had failed to see him the previous night. Grant decided on an experiment. He coughed. Instantly the hadrosaur froze, the big head suddenly still, the jaws no longer chewing. Only the eye moved, looking for the source of the sound. Then, after a moment, when there seemed to be no danger, the animal resumed chewing. Amazing, Grant thought. Sitting in his arms, Lex opened her eyes and said,
"Hey, what's that?"
The hadrosaur trumpeted in alarm, a loud, resonant honk that so startled Lex that she nearly fell out of the tree. The hadrosaur pulled its head away from the branch and trumpeted again.
"Don't make her mad," Tim said from the branch above.
The baby chirped and scurried beneath the mother's legs as the hadrosaur stepped away from the tree. The mother cocked her head and peered inquisitively at the branch where Grant and Lex were sitting. With its upturned smiling lips, the dinosaur had a comical appearance.
"Is it dumb?" Lex said.
"No," Grant said, "you just surprised her."
"Well," Lex said, "is she going to let us get down or what?"
The hadrosaur had backed 10 feet away from the tree. She honked again. Grant had the impression she was trying to frighten them away. But the dinosaur didn't really seem to know what to do. She acted confused and uneasy. They waited in silence, and after a minute the hadrosaur approached the branch again, jaws moving in anticipation. She was clearly going to resume eating.
"Forget it," Lex said. "I'm not staying here."
She started to climb down the branches. At her movement, the hadrosaur trumpeted in fresh alarm. Grant was amazed. He thought, "It really can't see us when we don't move. And after a minute, it literally forgets that we're here." This was just like the tyrannosaur, another classic example of an amphibian visual cortex. Studies of frogs had shown that amphibians only saw moving things like insects. If something didn't move, they literally didn't see it. The same thing seemed to be true of dinosaurs. In any case, the miasaur now seemed to find these strange creatures climbing down the tree too upsetting. With a final honk, she nudged her baby and lumbered slowly away. She paused once and looked back at them, then continued on. They reached the ground. Lex shook herself off. Both children were covered in a layer of fine dust. All around them, the grass had been flattened. There were streaks of blood and a sour smell. Grant looked at his watch. "We better get going, kids," he said.
"Not me," Lex said. "I'm not walking out there anymore."
"We have to."
"Why?"
"Because," Grant said, "we have to tell them about the boat. Since they can't seem to see us on the motion sensors, we have to go all the way back ourselves. It's the only way." Why can't we take the raft? Tim said. What raft? Tim pointed to the low concrete maintenance building with the bars where they had spent the night. It was 20 yards away across the field. I saw a raft back there, he said. Grant immediately understood the advantages. It was now 7 o'clock in the morning. They had at least 8 miles to go. If they could take a raft along the river, they would make much faster progress than going overland. Let's do it, Grant said. Arnold punched the visual search mode and watched as the monitors began to scan throughout the park, the images changing every 2 seconds. It was tiring to watch, but it was the fastest way to find Nedry's jeep, and Muldoon had been adamant about that. He'd gone out with Gennaro to look at the stampede, but now that it was daylight, he wanted the car found. He wanted the weapons. His intercom clicked. Mr. Arnold, may I have a word with you, please? It was Hammond. He sounded like the voice of God. You want to come here, Mr. Hammond?
No, Mr. Arnold, Hammond said. Come to me. I'm in the genetics lab with Dr. Wu. We'll be waiting for you.
Arnold sighed and stepped away from the screens. Grant stumbled deep in the gloomy recesses of the building. He pushed past 5-gallon containers of herbicide, tree-pruning equipment, spare tires for a jeep, coils of cyclone fencing, 100-pound fertilizer bags, stacks of brown ceramic insulators, empty motor oil cans, work lights and cables. I don't see any raft.
Keep going.
Bags of cement, lengths of copper pipe, green mesh, and 2 plastic oars hung on clips on the concrete wall.
Okay, he said, but where's the raft?
It must be here somewhere, Tim said.
You never saw a raft?
No, I just assumed it was here.
Poking among the junk, Grant found no raft. But he did find a set of plans rolled up and speckled with mold from humidity, stuck back in a metal cabinet on the wall. He spread the plans on the floor, brushing away a big spider. He looked at them for a long time.
I'm hungry.
Just a minute. They were detailed topographical charts for the main area of the island where they now were. According to this, the lagoon narrowed into the river they had seen earlier, which twisted northward, right through the aviary, and on to within a half mile of the visitor lodge. He flipped back through the pages. How to get to the lagoon? According to the plans, there should be a door at the back of the building they were in. Grant looked up and saw it, recessed back in the concrete wall. The door was wide enough for a car. Opening it, he saw a paved road running straight down toward the lagoon. The road was dug below ground level, so it couldn't be seen from above. Must be another service road. And it led to a dock at the edge of the lagoon. And clearly stenciled on the dock was raft storage.
Hey, Tim said, look at this.
He held out a metal case to Grant. Opening it, Grant found a compressed air pistol and a cloth belt that held darts. There were 6 darts in all, each as thick as his finger, labeled Moro 709. Good work, Tim. He slung the belt around his shoulder and stuck the gun in his trousers.
Is it a tranquilizer gun?
I'd say so.
What about the boat?
Lex said. I think it's on the dock, Grant said. They started down the road. Grant carried the oars on his shoulder.
I hope it's a big raft, Lex said, because I can't swim.
Don't worry, he said.
Maybe we can catch some fish, she said.
They walked down the road with a sloping embankment rising up on both sides of them. They heard a deep, rhythmic snorting sound, but Grant could not see where it was coming from.
Are you sure there's a raft down here?
Lex said, wrinkling her nose. Probably, Grant said. The rhythmic snorting became louder as they walked, but they also heard a steady droning, buzzing sound. When they reached the end of the road, at the edge of the small concrete dock, Grant froze in shock. The Tyrannosaur was right there. It was sitting upright in the shade of a tree, its hind legs stretched out in front. Its eyes were open, but it was not moving, except for its head, which lifted and fell gently with each snorting sound. The buzzing came from the clouds of flies that surrounded it, crawling over its face and slack jaws, its bloody fangs, and the red haunch of a killed hadrosaur that lay on its side behind the Tyrannosaur. The Tyrannosaur was only 20 yards away. Grant felt sure it must have seen him, but the big animal did not respond. It just sat there. It took him a moment to realize. The Tyrannosaur was asleep, sitting up but asleep. He signaled to Tim and Lex to stay where they were. Grant walked slowly forward onto the dock in full view of the Tyrannosaur. The big animal continued to sleep, snoring softly. Near the end of the dock, a wooden shed was painted green to blend with the foliage. Grant quietly unlatched the door and looked inside. He saw a half-dozen orange life vests hanging on the wall, several rolls of wire mesh fencing, some coils of rope, and two big rubber cubes sitting on the floor. The cubes were strapped tight with flat rubber belts. Rafts. He looked back at Lex. She mouthed, "No boat." He nodded, "Yes." The Tyrannosaur raised its forelimb to swipe at the flies buzzing around its snout, but otherwise it did not move. Grant pulled one of the cubes out onto the dock. It was surprisingly heavy. He freed the straps, found the inflation cylinder. With a loud hiss, the rubber began to expand, and then with a hiss, whap, it popped fully open on the dock. The sound was fearfully loud in their ears. Grant turned, stared up at the dinosaur. The Tyrannosaur grunted and snorted. It began to move. Grant braced himself to run, but the animal shifted its ponderous bulk, and then it settled back against the tree trunk and gave a long, growling belch. Lex looked disgusted, waving her hand in front of her face. Grant was soaked in sweat from the tension. He dragged the rubber raft across the dock. It flopped into the water with a loud splash. The dinosaur continued to sleep. Grant tied the boat up to the dock and returned to the shed to take out two life preservers. He put these in the boat and then waved for the kids to come out onto the dock. Pale with fear, Lex waved back,
"No."
He gestured, "Yes." The Tyrannosaur continued to sleep. Grant stabbed in the air with an emphatic finger. Lex came silently, and he gestured for her to get into the raft. Then Tim got in, and they both put on their life vests. Grant got in and pushed off. The raft drifted silently out into the lagoon. Grant picked up his paddles and fitted them into the oarlocks. They moved farther from the dock. Lex sat back and sighed loudly with relief. Then she looked stricken and put her hand over her mouth. Her body shook with muffled sounds. She was suppressing a cough. She always coughed at the wrong times. "Lex!" Tim whispered fiercely, looking back toward the shore. She shook her head miserably and pointed to her throat. He knew what she meant, a tickle in her throat. What she needed was a drink of water. Grant was rowing, and Tim leaned over the side of the raft and scooped his hand in the lagoon, holding his cupped hand toward her. Lex coughed loudly, explosively. In Tim's ears, the sound echoed across the water like a gunshot. The Tyrannosaur yawned lazily and scratched behind its ear with its hind foot, just like a dog. It yawned again. It was groggy after its big meal, and it woke up slowly. On the boat, Lex was making little gargling sounds.
"Lex, shut up," Tim said. "I can't help it,"
she whispered, and then she coughed again. Grant rowed hard, moving the raft powerfully into the center of the lagoon. On the shore, the Tyrannosaur stumbled to its feet.
"I couldn't help it, Timmy,"
Lex shrieked miserably.
"I couldn't help it. Shh!"
Grant was rowing as fast as he could.
"Anyway, it doesn't matter," she said. "We're far enough away. He can't swim." "Of course he can swim, you little idiot,"
Tim shouted at her. On the shore, the Tyrannosaur stepped off the dock and plunged into the water. It moved strongly into the lagoon after them.
"Well, how should I know?" she said. "Everybody knows Tyrannosaurs can swim. It's in all the books. Anyway, all reptiles can swim." "Snakes can't." "Of course snakes can, you idiot."
"Settle down," Grant said. "Hold on to something." Grant was watching the Tyrannosaur, noticing how the animal swam. The Tyrannosaur was now chest deep in the water, but it could hold its big head high above the surface. Then Grant realized the animal wasn't swimming. It was walking. Because moments later, only the very top of the head, the eyes and nostrils protruded above the surface. By then it looked like a crocodile, and it swam like a crocodile, swinging its big tail back and forth, so the water churned behind it. Behind the head, Grant saw the hump of the back and the ridges along the length of tail as it occasionally broke the surface. Exactly like a crocodile, he thought unhappily. The biggest crocodile in the world.
"I'm sorry, Dr. Grant,"
Lex wailed.
"I didn't mean it."
Grant glanced over his shoulder. The lagoon was no more than 100 yards wide here, and they'd almost reached the center. If he continued, the water would become shallow again. The Tyrannosaur would be able to walk again, and he would move faster in shallow water. Grant swung the boat around and began to row north.
What are you doing?
The Tyrannosaur was now just a few yards away. Grant could hear its sharp snorting breaths as it came closer. Grant looked at the paddles in his hands, but they were light plastic, not weapons at all. The Tyrannosaur threw its head back and opened its jaws wide, showing rows of curved teeth. And then, in a great muscular spasm, lunged forward to the raft, just missing the rubber gunwale, the huge skull slapping down, the raft rocking away on the crest of the splash. The Tyrannosaur sank below the surface, leaving gurgling bubbles. The lagoon was still. Lex gripped the gunwale handles and looked back.
Did he drown?
No, Grant said. He saw bubbles, then a faint ripple along the surface, coming toward the boat. Hang on, he shouted, as the head bucked up beneath the rubber, bending the boat and lifting it into the air, spinning them crazily before it splashed down again.
Do something,
Alexis screamed.
Do something!
Grant pulled the air pistol out of his belt. It looked pitifully small in his hands, but there was the chance that if he shot the animal in a sensitive spot, in the eye or the nose, the Tyrannosaur surfaced beside the boat, opened its jaws, and roared. Grant aimed and fired. The dart flashed in the light and smacked into the cheek. The Tyrannosaur shook its head and roared again, and suddenly they heard an answering roar floating across the water toward them. Looking back, Grant saw the juvenile T-Rex on the shore, crouched over the killed sauropod, claiming the kill as its own. The juvenile slashed at the carcass, then raised its head high and bellowed. The big Tyrannosaur saw it too, and the response was immediate. It turned back to protect its kill, swimming strongly toward the shore.
He's going away,
Lex squealed, clapping her hands.
He's going away! Na-na-na-na-na, stupid dinosaur!
From the shore, the juvenile roared defiantly. Enraged, the big Tyrannosaur burst from the lagoon at full speed, water streaming from its enormous body as it raced up the hill past the dock. The juvenile ducked its head and fled, its jaws still filled with ragged flesh. The big Tyrannosaur chased it, racing past the dead sauropod, disappearing over the hill. They heard its final threatening bellow, and then the raft moved to the north, around a bend in the lagoon, to the river. Exhausted from rowing, Grant collapsed back, his chest heaving. He couldn't catch his breath. He lay gasping in the raft.
Are you okay, Dr. Grant?
Lex asked.
From now on, will you just do what I tell you?
Okay,
she sighed, as if he had just made the most unreasonable demand in the world. She trailed her arm in the water for a while.
You stopped rowing, she said.
I'm tired, Grant said.
Then how come we're still moving?
Grant sat up. She was right. The raft drifted steadily north.
There must be a current.
The current was carrying them north, toward the hotel. He looked at his watch and was astonished to see it was 7:15. Only 15 minutes had passed since he had last looked at his watch. It seemed like 2 hours. Grant lay back against the rubber gunwales, closed his eyes, and slept. Fifth iteration. Flaws in the system will now become severe. Ian Malcolm. Search. Gennaro sat in the jeep and listened to the buzzing of the flies, and stared at the distant palm trees wavering in the heat. He was astonished by what looked like a battleground. The grass was trampled flat for 100 yards in every direction. One big palm tree was uprooted from the ground. There were great washes of blood in the grass, and on the rocky outcropping to their right. Sitting beside him, Muldoon said,
No doubt about it. Rexy's been among the Hadrosaurs.
He took another drink of whiskey and capped the bottle.
Damn lot of flies, he said.
They waited and watched. Gennaro drummed his fingers on the dashboard.
What are we waiting for?
Muldoon didn't answer immediately.
The Rex is out there somewhere, he said, squinting at the landscape in the morning sun. And we don't have any weapons worth a damn.
We're in a jeep.
Oh, we can outrun the jeep, Mr. Gennaro, Muldoon said, shaking his head. Once we leave this road and go on to open terrain, the best we can do in a four-wheel drive is 30-40 miles an hour. He'll run us right down, no problem for him.
Muldoon sighed.
But I don't see much moving out there now.
You ready to live dangerously?
Sure,
Gennaro said. Muldoon started the engine, and at the sudden sound, two small Othnelians leapt up from the matted grass directly ahead. Muldoon put the car in gear. He drove in a wide circle around the trampled site, and then moved inward, driving in decreasing concentric circles until he finally came to the place in the field where the little Othnelians had been. Then he got out and walked forward in the grass away from the jeep. He stopped as a dense cloud of flies lifted into the air.
What is it?
Gennaro called.
Bring the radio, Muldoon said.
Gennaro climbed out of the jeep and hurried forward. Even from a distance he could smell the sour-sweet odor of early decay. He saw a dark shape in the grass, crusted with blood, legs askew.
Young Hadrosaur, Muldoon said, staring down at the carcass. The whole herd stampeded, and the young one got separated, and the T-Rex brought it down.
How do you know? Gennaro said. The flesh was ragged from many bites.
You can tell from the excreta, Muldoon said. See those chalky white bits there in the grass? That's hadrospore. Uric acid makes it white. But you look there,
he pointed to a large mound rising knee-high in the grass,
that's tyrannosaur spore.
How do you know the tyrannosaur didn't come later?
The bite pattern, Muldoon said. See those little ones there?
He pointed along the belly.
Those are from the Othis. Those bites haven't bled. They're post-mortem from scavengers. Othis did that. But the hadro was brought down by a bite on the neck. You see the big slash there, above the shoulder blades? That's the T-Rex, no question.
Gennaro bent over the carcass, staring at the awkward, trampled limbs with a sense of unreality.
Beside him, Muldoon flicked on his radio. Control?
Yes,
John Arnold said over the radio.
We got another hadro dead. Juvenile.
Muldoon bent down among the flies and checked the skin on the sole of the right foot. A number was tattooed there.
Specimen is number HD-09.
The radio crackled.
I've got something for you, Arnold said.
Oh, what's that?
I found Nedry.
The jeep burst through the line of palm trees along the east road and came out into a narrower service road leading toward the jungle river. It was hot in this area of the park, the jungle close and fetid around them. Muldoon was fiddling with a computer monitor in the jeep, which now showed a map of the resort with overlaid grid lines.
They found him up on remote video, he said. Sector 1104 is just ahead.
Farther up the road, Gennaro saw a concrete barrier, and the jeep parked alongside it.
He must have taken the wrong turnoff, Muldoon said,
the little bastard.
What did he take?
Gennaro asked.
Who says 15 embryos? Know what that's worth?
Gennaro shook his head.
Somewhere between 2 and 10 million,
Muldoon said. He shook his head.
Big stakes.
As they came closer, Gennaro saw the body lying beside the car. The body was indistinct and green. But then green shapes scattered away as the jeep pulled to a stop.
Compies, Muldoon said. The compies found him.
A dozen procompsognathids, delicate little predators no larger than ducks, stood at the edge of the jungle, chittering excitedly as the men climbed out of the car. Dennis Nedry lay on his back, the chubby boyish face now red and bloated. Flies buzzed around the gaping mouth and thick tongue. His body was mangled, the intestines torn open, one leg chewed through. Gennaro turned away quickly to look at the little compies which squatted on their hind legs a short distance away and watched the men curiously. The little dinosaurs had five-fingered hands, he noticed. They wiped their faces and chins, giving them an eerily human quality which,
I'll be damned, Muldoon said. Wasn't the compies?
What?
Muldoon was shaking his head.
See these blotches? On his shirt and face? Smell that sweet smell like old dried vomit?
Gennaro rolled his eyes. He smelled it.
That's Dillo saliva, Muldoon said. Spit from the Dilophosaurs. You see the damage on the corneas, all that redness? In the eyes, it's painful, but not fatal. You've got about 2 hours to wash it out with the antivenin. We keep it all around the park, just in case. Not that it mattered to this bastard. They blinded him, then ripped him down the middle. Not a nice way to go. Maybe there's justice in the world after all.
The procompsognathid squeaked and hopped up and down as Muldoon opened the back door and took out gray metal tubing in a stainless steel case.
It's all still there, he said.
He handed two dark cylinders to Gennaro. What are these? Gennaro said.
Just what they look like, Muldoon said. Rockets.
As Gennaro backed away, he said, Watch it. You don't want to step in something. Gennaro stepped carefully over Nedry's body. Muldoon carried the tubing to the other jeep and placed it in the back. He climbed behind the wheel.
Let's go.
What about him? Gennaro said, pointing to the body.
What about him, Muldoon said. We've got things to do.
He put the car in gear. Looking back, Gennaro saw the compies resume their feeding. One jumped up and squatted on Nedry's open mouth as it nibbled the flesh of his nose. The jungle river became narrower. The banks closed in on both sides until the trees and foliage overhanging the banks met high above to block out the sun. Tim heard the cry of birds and saw small chirping dinosaurs leaping among the branches. But mostly it was silent, the air hot and still beneath the canopy of trees. Grant looked at his watch. It was 8 o'clock. They drifted along peacefully among dappled patches of light. If anything, they seemed to be moving faster than before. Awake now, Grant lay on his back and stared up at the branches overhead. In the bow, he saw Lex reaching up. Hey, what are you doing? He said.
Do you think we can eat these berries?
She pointed to the trees. Some of the overhanging branches were close enough to touch. Tim saw clusters of bright red berries on the branches. No, Grant said.
Why, those little dinosaurs are eating them.
She pointed to small dinosaurs scampering in the branches.
No, Lex.
She sighed, dissatisfied with his authority.
I wish Daddy was here, she said. Daddy always knows what to do. What are you talking about, Tim said. He never knows what to do. Yes, he does,
she sighed. Lex stared at the trees as they slid past, their big roots twisting toward the water's edge.
Just because you're not his favorite.
Tim turned away, said nothing.
But don't worry. Daddy likes you, too, even if you're into computers and not sports.
Dad's a real sports nut, Tim explained to Grant. Grant nodded. Up in the branches, small, pale yellow dinosaurs, barely 2 feet tall, hopped from tree to tree. They had beaky heads like parrots.
You know what they call those? Tim said. Microceratops. Big deal, Lex said. I thought you might be interested. Only very young boys, she said, are interested in dinosaurs. Says who? Daddy.
Tim started to yell, but Grant raised his hand. Kids, he said, shut up.
Why, Lex said, I can do what I want if I...
Then she fell silent, because she heard it too. It was a blood-curdling shriek from somewhere downriver.
Well, where the hell is the damned Rex? Muldoon said, talking into the radio. Because we don't see him here.
They were back at the sauropod compound, looking out at the trampled grass where the hadrosaurs had stampeded. The tyrannosaur was nowhere to be found.
Checking now, Arnold said and clicked off.
Muldoon turned to Gennaro.
Checking now, he repeated sarcastically. Why the hell didn't he check before? Why didn't he keep track of him?
I don't know, Gennaro said.
He's not showing up, Arnold said a moment later. What do you mean he's not showing up? He's not on the monitors. Motion sensors aren't finding him. Hell, Muldoon said. So much for the motion sensors. You see Grant and the kids? Motion sensors aren't finding them either. Well, what are we supposed to do now? Muldoon said.
Wait, Arnold said.
Look! Look!
Directly ahead, the big dome of the aviary rose above them. Grant had seen it only from a distance. Now he realized it was enormous, a quarter of a mile in diameter or more. The pattern of geodesic struts shone dully through the light mist, and his first thought was that the glass must weigh a ton. Then as they came closer, he saw there wasn't any glass, just struts. A thin mesh hung inside the elements.
It isn't finished, Lex said.
I think it's meant to be open like that, Grant said.
Then all the birds can fly out.
Not if they're big birds, Grant said. The river carried them beneath the edge of the dome. They stared upward. Now they were inside the dome, still drifting down the river. But within minutes, the dome was so high above them that it was hardly visible in the mist. Grant said, I seem to remember there's a second lodge here. Moments later, he saw the roof of a building over the tops of the trees to the north.
You want to stop? Tim said.
Maybe there's a phone, or motion sensors.
Grant steered toward the shore. We need to try to contact the control room. It's getting late. They clambered out, slipping on the muddy bank, and Grant hauled the raft out of the water. Then he tied the rope to a tree, and they set off through a dense forest of palm trees.
Aviary.
I just don't understand, John Arnold said, speaking into the phone. I don't see the wrecks, and I don't see Grant and the kids anywhere either.
He sat in front of the consoles and gulped another cup of coffee. All around him, the control room was strewn with paper plates and half-eaten sandwiches. Arnold was exhausted. It was 8 a.m. on Saturday. In the 14 hours since Nedry destroyed the computer that ran Jurassic Park, Arnold had patiently pulled systems back online, one after another.
All the park systems are back and functioning correctly. The phones are working. I've called for a doctor for you.
On the other end of the line, Malcolm coughed. Arnold was talking to him in his room at the lodge.
But you're having trouble with the motion sensors? Well, I'm not finding what I'm looking for. Like the wrecks? He's not reading at all now. He started north about 20 minutes ago, following along the edge of the lagoon, and then I lost him. I don't know why, unless he's gone to sleep again.
And you can't find Grant and the kids?
No.
I think it's quite simple, Malcolm said. The motion sensors cover an inadequate area.
Inadequate?
Arnold bristled. They cover 92%
of the land area, I remember, Malcolm said. But if you put the remaining areas up on the board, I think you'll find that the 8% is topologically unified, meaning that those areas are contiguous. In essence, an animal can move freely anywhere in the park and escape detection by following a maintenance road or the jungle river or the beaches or whatever.
Even if that were so, Arnold said, the animals are too stupid to know that. It's not clear how stupid the animals are, Malcolm said.
You think that's what Grant and the kids are doing?
Arnold said.
Definitely not, Malcolm said, coughing again. Grant's no fool. He clearly wants to be detected by you. He and the kids are probably waving at every motion sensor in sight. But maybe they have other problems we don't know about. Or maybe they're on the river. I can't imagine they'd be on the river. The banks are very narrow. It's impossible to walk along there.
Would the river bring them all the way back here?
Yes, but it's not the safest way to go, because it passes through the aviary.
Why wasn't the aviary on the tour? Malcolm said.
We've had problems setting it up. Originally, the park was intended to have a treetop lodge built high above the ground where visitors could observe the pterodactyls at flight level. We've got 4 dactyls in the aviary now. Actually, they're ceradactyls, which are big fish-eating dactyls.
What about them?
Well, while we finished the lodge, we put the dactyls in the aviary to acclimate them. But that was a big mistake. It turns out our fish hunters are territorial.
Territorial?
Fiercely territorial, Arnold said. They fight among themselves for territory, and they'll attack any other animal that comes into the area they've marked out.
Attack?
It's impressive, Arnold said. The dactyls glide to the top of the aviary, fold up their wings, and dive. A 30-pound animal will strike a man on the ground like a ton of bricks. They were knocking the workmen unconscious, cutting them up pretty badly.
That doesn't injure the dactyls?
Not so far. So if those kids are in the aviary...
They're not, Arnold said. At least I hope they're not.
Is that the lodge? Lex said. What a dump.
Beneath the aviary dome, Terratop's lodge was built high above the ground on big wooden pylons in the middle of a stand of fir trees. But the building was unfinished and unpainted. The windows were boarded up. The trees and the lodge were splattered with broad white streaks.
I guess they didn't finish it for some reason, Grant said, hiding his disappointment. He glanced at his watch. Come on, let's go back to the boat.
The sun came out as they walked along, making the morning more cheerful. Grant looked at the latticework shadows on the ground from the dome above. He noticed that the ground and the foliage were spattered with broad streaks of the same white chalky substance that had been on the building, and there was a distinctive sour odor in the morning air.
Stinks here, Lex said. What's all that white stuff?
Looks like reptile droppings, probably from the birds.
How come they didn't finish the lodge?
I don't know.
They entered a clearing of low grass dotted with wildflowers. They heard a long, low whistle, then an answering whistle from across the forest.
What's that?
I don't know. Then Grant saw the dark shadow of a cloud on the grassy field ahead. The shadow was moving fast. In moments it had swept over them. He looked up and saw an enormous dark shape gliding above them, blotting out the sun.
Yow! Lex said. Is it a pterodactyl?
Yes, Tim said. Grant didn't answer. He was entranced by the sight of the huge flying creature. In the sky above, the pterodactyl gave a low whistle and wheeled gracefully, turning back toward them.
How come they're not on the tour? Tim said.
Grant was wondering the same thing. The flying dinosaurs were so beautiful, so graceful as they moved through the air. As Grant watched, he saw a second pterodactyl appear in the sky, and a third, and a fourth.
Maybe because they didn't finish the lodge, Lex said.
Grant was thinking these weren't ordinary pterodactyls. They were too large. They must be ceratodactyls, big flying reptiles from the early Cretaceous. When they were high, these looked like small airplanes. When they came lower, he could see the animals had 15-foot wingspans, furry bodies, and heads like crocodiles. They ate fish, he remembered, South America and Mexico. Lex shaded her eyes and looked up at the sky.
Can they hurt us?
I don't think so. They eat fish. One of the dactyls spiraled down, a flashing dark shadow that whooshed past them with a rush of warm air and a lingering sour odor.
Wow, Lex said. They're really big.
And then she said,
Are you sure they can't hurt us?
Pretty sure. A second dactyl swooped down, moving faster than the first. It came from behind, streaked over their heads. Grant had a glimpse of its toothy beak and the furry body. It looked like a huge bat, he thought. But Grant was impressed with the frail appearance of the animals. Their huge wingspans, the delicate pink membranes stretched across them, so thin they were translucent, everything reinforced the delicacy of the dactyls.
Ow! Lex shouted, grabbing her hair. He bit me!
He what? Grant said.
He bit me! He bit me!
When she took her hand away, he saw blood on her fingers. Up in the sky, two more dactyls folded their wings, collapsing into small, dark shapes that plummeted toward the ground. They made a kind of scream as they hurtled downward. Come on! Grant said, grabbing their hands. They ran across the meadow, hearing the approaching scream, and he flung himself on the ground at the last moment, pulling the kids down with him, as the two dactyls whistled and squeaked past them, flapping their wings. Grant felt claws tear the shirt along his back. Then he was up, pulling Lex back onto her feet, and running with Tim a few feet forward, while overhead two more birds wheeled and dove toward them, screaming. At the last moment, he pushed the kids to the ground, and the big shadows flapped past.
Ugh!
Lex said, disgusted. He saw that she was streaked with white droppings from the birds. Grant scrambled to his feet. Come on! He was about to run when Lex shrieked in terror. He turned back and saw that one of the dactyls had grabbed her by the shoulders with its hind claws. The animal's huge, leathery wings, translucent in the sunlight, flapped broadly on both sides of her. The dactyl was trying to take off, but Lex was too heavy, and while it struggled, it repeatedly jabbed at her head with its long, pointed jaw. Lex was screaming, waving her arms wildly. Grant did the only thing he could think to do. He ran forward and jumped up, throwing himself against the body of the dactyl. He knocked it onto its back on the ground and fell on top of the furry body. The animal screamed and snapped. Grant ducked his head away from the jaws and pushed back as the giant wings beat around his body. It was like being in a tent in a windstorm. He couldn't see, he couldn't hear. There was nothing but the flapping and shrieking and the leathery membranes. The clawed legs scratched frantically at his chest. Lex was screaming. Grant pushed away from the dactyl, and it squeaked and gibbered as it flapped its wings and struggled to turn over to right itself. Finally, it pulled in its wings like a bat and rolled over, lifted itself up on its little wing claws, and began to walk that way. He paused, astonished. It could walk on its wings. Lederer's speculation was right. But then the other dactyls were diving down at them, and Grant was dizzy, off balance, and in horror he saw Lex run away, her arms over her head, Tim shouting at the top of his lungs. The first of them swooped down, and she threw something, and suddenly the dactyl whistled and climbed. The other dactyls immediately climbed and chased the first into the sky. The fourth dactyl flapped awkwardly into the air to join the others. Grant looked upward, squinting to see what had happened. The three dactyls chased the first, screaming angrily. They were alone in the field.
"What happened?" Grant said.
"They got my glove," Lex said. "My Daryl Strawberry Special."
They started walking again. Tim put his arm around her shoulders.
"Are you all right?"
"Of course, stupid,"
she said, shaking him off. She looked upward.
"I hope they choke and die,"
she said. "Yeah," Tim said. "Me too." Up ahead, they saw the boat on the shore. Grant looked at his watch. It was 8:30. He now had 2.5 hours to get back. Lex cheered as they drifted beyond the silver aviary dome. Then the banks of the river closed in on both sides, the trees meeting overhead once more. The river was narrower than ever, in some places only 10 feet wide, and the current flowed very fast. Lex reached up to touch the branches as they went past. Grant sat back in the raft and listened to the gurgle of the water through the warm rubber. They were moving fast now, the branches overhead slipping by more rapidly. It was pleasant. It gave a little breeze in the hot confines of the overhanging branches, and it meant they would get back that much sooner. Grant couldn't guess how far they had come, but it must be several miles at least from the sauropod building where they had spent the night, perhaps 4 or 5 miles, maybe even more. That meant they might be only an hour's walk from the hotel once they left the raft. But after the aviary, Grant was in no hurry to leave the river again. For the moment, they were making good time.
"I wonder how Ralph is," Lex said. "He's probably dead or something."
"I'm sure he's fine."
"I wonder if he'd let me ride him."
She sighed, sleepy in the sun.
"That would be fun, to ride Ralph."
Tim said to Grant,
"Remember back at the Stegosaurus last night?"
"Yes."
"How come you asked them about frog DNA?"
"Because of the breeding," Grant said. "They can't explain why the dinosaurs are breeding, since they irradiate them and since they're all females."
"Right."
"Well, irradiation is notoriously unreliable, and probably doesn't work. I think that'll eventually be shown here. But there is still the problem of the dinosaurs being female. How can they breed when they're all female?"
"Right," Tim said.
"Well, across the animal kingdom, sexual reproduction exists in extraordinary variety."
"Tim's very interested in sex,"
Lex said. They both ignored her. "For example," Grant said, "many animals have sexual reproduction without ever having what we would call sex. The male releases a spermatophore, which contains the sperm, and the female picks it up at a later time. This kind of exchange does not require quite as much physical differentiation between male and female as we usually think exists. Male and female are more alike in some animals than they are in human beings." Tim nodded.
"But what about the frogs?"
Grant heard sudden shrieks from the trees above as the Microceratopsians scattered in alarm, shaking the branches. The big head of the Tyrannosaur lunged through the foliage from the left, the jaws snapping at the raft. Lex howled in terror, and Grant paddled away toward the opposite bank, but the river here was only 10 feet wide. The Tyrannosaur was caught in the heavy growth. It butted and twisted its head and roared. Then it pulled its head back. Through the trees that lined the riverbank, they saw the huge dark form of the Tyrannosaur moving north, looking for a gap in the trees that lined the bank. The Microceratopsians had all gone to the opposite bank, where they shrieked and scampered and jumped up and down. In the raft, Grant, Tim, and Lex stared helplessly as the Tyrannosaur tried to break through again. But the trees were too dense along the banks of the river. The Tyrannosaur again moved downstream ahead of the boat and tried again, shaking the branches furiously. But again it failed. Then it moved off, heading farther downstream.
"I hate him,"
Lex said. Grant sat back in the boat, badly shaken. If the Tyrannosaur had broken through, there was nothing he could have done to save them. The river was so narrow that it was hardly wider than the raft. It was like being in a tunnel. The rubber gunwales often scraped on the mud as the boat was pulled along by the swift current. He glanced at his watch. Almost 9. The raft continued downstream.
"Hey,"
Lex said.
"Listen."
He heard snarling, interspersed by a repeated hooting cry. The cries were coming from beyond a curve farther downriver. He listened and heard the hooting again.
"What is it?"
Lex said. I don't know, Grant said, but there's more than one of them. He paddled the boat to the opposite bank, grabbed a branch to stop the raft. The snarling was repeated, then more hooting.
It sounds like a bunch of owls, Tim said.
Malcolm groaned.
Isn't it time for more morphine yet?
Not yet,
Ellie said. Malcolm sighed.
How much water have we got here?
I don't know. There's plenty of running water from the tap.
No, I mean, how much stored? Any?
Ellie shrugged.
None.
Go into the rooms on this floor, Malcolm said, and fill the bathtubs with water.
Ellie frowned.
Also, Malcolm said, have we got any walkie-talkies? Flashlights? Matches? Sterno stoves? Things like that?
I'll look around. You planning for an earthquake?
Something like that, Malcolm said. Malcolm effect implies catastrophic changes.
But Arnold says all the systems are working perfectly.
That's when it happens, Malcolm said.
Ellie said,
you don't think much of Arnold, do you?
He's all right. He's an engineer. Wu's the same. They're both technicians. They don't have intelligence. They have what I call thin intelligence. They see the immediate situation. They think narrowly, and they call it being focused. They don't see the surround. They don't see the consequences. That's how you get an island like this, from thin intelligent thinking. Because you cannot make an animal and not expect it to act alive, to be unpredictable, to escape. But they don't see that.
Don't you think it's just human nature?
Ellie said.
God, no, Malcolm said. That's like saying scrambled eggs and bacon for breakfast is human nature. It's nothing of the sort. It's uniquely Western training. And much of the rest of the world is nauseated by the thought of it.
He winced in pain.
Oh, the morphine's making me philosophical.
You want some water?
No. I'll tell you the problem with engineers and scientists. Scientists have an elaborate line of bullshit about how they are seeking to know the truth about nature, which is true, but that's not what drives them. Nobody is driven by abstractions like seeking truth. Scientists are actually preoccupied with accomplishment, so they are focused on whether they can do something. They never stop to ask if they should do something. They conveniently define such considerations as pointless. If they don't do it, someone else will. Discovery, they believe, is inevitable, so they just try to do it first. That's the game in science. Even pure scientific discovery is an aggressive, penetrative act. It takes big equipment, and it literally changes the world afterward. Particle accelerators scar the land and leave radioactive byproducts. Astronauts leave trash on the moon. There's always some proof that scientists were there, making their discoveries. Discovery is always a rape of the natural world, always. The scientists want it that way. They have to stick their instruments in, they have to leave their mark. They can't just watch. They can't just appreciate. They can't just fit into the natural order. They have to make something unnatural happen. That is the scientist's job. And now we have whole societies that try to be scientific.
He sighed and sank back.
Ellie said, don't you think you're overstating?
What does one of your excavations look like a year later?
Pretty bad, she admitted.
You don't replant? You don't restore the land after you dig?
No.
Why not?
She shrugged.
There's no money, I guess.
There's only enough money to dig, but not to repair.
Well, we're just working in the Badlands.
Just the Badlands, Malcolm said, shaking his head. Just trash, just byproducts, just side effects. I'm trying to tell you that scientists want it this way. They want byproducts and trash and scars and side effects. It's a way of reassuring themselves. It's built into the fabric of science, and it's increasingly a disaster.
Then what's the answer?
Get rid of the thin, intelligent ones. Take them out of power.
But then we'd lose all the advances.
What advances? Malcolm said irritably. The number of hours women devote to housework has not changed since 1930, despite all the advances. All the vacuum cleaners, washer dryers, trash compactors, garbage disposals, wash and wear fabrics. Why does it still take as long to clean the house as it did in 1930?
Ellie said nothing.
Because there haven't been any advances, Malcolm said. Not really. 30,000 years ago, when men were doing cave paintings at Lascaux, they worked 20 hours a week to provide themselves with food and shelter and clothing. The rest of the time they could play or sleep or do whatever they wanted.
And they lived in a natural world with clean air, clean water, beautiful trees and sunsets. Think about it, 20 hours a week, 30,000 years ago.
Ellie said, "You want to turn back the clock?"
"No," Malcolm said. "I want people to wake up. We've had 400 years of modern science, and we ought to know by now what it's good for and what it's not good for. It's time for a change."
"Before we destroy the planet," she said. He sighed and closed his eyes.
"Oh, dear," he said. "That's the last thing I would worry about."
In the dark tunnel of the jungle river, Grant went hand over hand, holding branches, moving the raft cautiously forward. He still heard the sounds, and finally he saw the dinosaurs.
"Aren't those the ones that are poison?"
"Yes," Grant said. "Dilophosaurus." Standing on the riverbank were two Dilophosaurs. The 10-foot-tall bodies were spotted yellow and black. Underneath, the bellies were bright green, like lizards. Twin red curving crests ran along the top of the head from the eyes to the nose, making a V-shape above the head. The bird-like quality was reinforced by the way they moved, bending to drink from the river, then rising to snarl and hoot.
Lex whispered, "Should we get out and walk?"
Grant shook his head no. The Dilophosaurs were smaller than the Tyrannosaur, small enough to slip through the dense foliage at the banks of the river. They seemed quick as they snarled and hooted at each other.
"But we can't get past them in the boat," Lex said. "They're poison."
"We have to," Grant said, "somehow." The Dilophosaurs continued to drink and hoot. They seemed to be interacting with each other in a strangely ritualistic, repetitive way. The animal on the left would bend to drink, opening its mouth to bear long rows of sharp teeth, and then it would hoot. The animal on the right would hoot in reply and bend to drink, in a mirror image of the first animal's movements. Then the sequence would be repeated exactly the same way. Grant noticed that the animal on the right was smaller, with smaller spots on its back, and its crest was a duller red.
"I'll be damned," he said. "It's a mating ritual."
"Can we get past them?"
Tim asked.
"Not the way they are now. They're right by the edge of the water."
Grant knew animals often performed such mating rituals for hours at a time. They went without food. They paid attention to nothing else. He glanced at his watch. 9:20.
"What do we do?"
Tim said. Grant sighed. "I have no idea." He sat down in the raft, and then the Dilophosaurs began to honk and roar repeatedly in agitation. He looked up. The animals were both facing away from the river.
"What is it?"
Lex said. Grant smiled. "I think we're finally getting some help." He pushed off from the bank. "I want you two kids to lie flat on the rubber. We'll go past as fast as we can, but just remember, whatever happens, don't say anything. And don't move, okay?" The raft began to drift downstream toward the hooting Dilophosaurs. It gained speed. Lex lay at Grant's feet, staring at him with frightened eyes. They were coming closer to the Dilophosaurs, which were still turned away from the river. But he pulled out his air pistol, checked the chamber. The raft continued on, and they smelled a peculiar odor, sweet and nauseating at the same time. It smelled like dried vomit. The hooting of the Dilophosaurs was louder. The raft came around a final bend, and Grant caught his breath. The Dilophosaurs were just a few feet away, honking at the trees beyond the river. As Grant had suspected, they were honking at the Tyrannosaur. The Tyrannosaur was trying to break through the foliage, and the Dillos hooted and stomped their feet in the mud. The raft drifted past them. The smell was nauseating. The Tyrannosaur roared, probably because it saw the raft. But in another moment, a thump. The raft stopped moving. They were aground against the riverbank, just a few feet downstream from the Dilophosaurs. Lex whispered,
"Oh, great."
There was a long, slow scraping sound of the raft against the mud. Then the raft was moving again. They were going down the river. The Tyrannosaur roared a final time and moved off. One Dilophosaur looked surprised, then hooted. The other Dilophosaur hooted in reply. The raft floated downriver. Tyrannosaur. The jeep bounced along in the glaring sun. Muldoon was driving, with Gennaro at his side.
They were in an open field moving away from the dense line of foliage and palm trees that marked the course of the river 100 yards to the east. They came to a rise, and Muldoon stopped the car.
"Christ, it's hot," he said, wiping his forehead with the back of his arm. He drank from the bottle of whiskey between his knees, then offered it to Gennaro. Gennaro shook his head. He stared at the landscape shimmering in the morning heat. Then he looked down at the onboard computer and video monitor mounted in the dashboard. The monitor showed views of the park from remote cameras. Still no sign of Grant and the children, or of the Tyrannosaur. The radio crackled.
Muldoon!
Muldoon picked up the handset.
Yeah. You got your onboards? I found the Rex. He's in grid 442, going to 443.
Just a minute, Muldoon said, adjusting the monitor.
Yeah, I got him now. Following the river.
The animal was slinking along the foliage that lined the banks of the river going north.
Take it easy with him, just immobilize him. Don't worry, Muldoon said, squinting in the sun. I won't hurt him.
Remember, Arnold said, the Tyrannosaur's our main tourist attraction. Muldoon turned off his radio with a crackle of static.
Bloody fool, he said. They're still talking about tourists.
Muldoon started the engine. Let's go see Rexy and give him a dose. The jeep jolted over the terrain.
You're looking forward to this, Gennaro said. I've wanted to put a needle in this big bastard for a while, Muldoon said. And there he is.
They came to a wrenching stop. Through the windshield, Gennaro saw the Tyrannosaur directly ahead of them, moving among the palm trees along the river. Muldoon drained the whiskey bottle and threw it in the back seat. He reached back for his tubing. Gennaro looked at the video monitor which showed their jeep and the Tyrannosaur. There must be a closed-circuit camera in the trees somewhere behind.
You want to help? Muldoon said. You can break out those canisters by your feet.
Gennaro bent over and opened a stainless steel Halliburton case. It was padded inside with foam. Four cylinders, each the size of a quart milk bottle, were nestled in the foam. They were all labeled Moro 709. He took one out.
You snap off the tip and screw on a needle, Muldoon explained.
Gennaro found a plastic package of large needles, each the diameter of his fingertip. He screwed one onto the canister. The opposite end of the canister had a circular lead weight.
That's the plunger. Compresses on impact.
Muldoon sat forward with the air rifle across his knees. It was made of heavy gray tubular metal and looked to Gennaro like a bazooka or a rocket launcher.
What's Moro 709? Standard animal trank, Muldoon said. Zoos around the world use it. We'll try 1,000 cc's to start.
Muldoon cracked open the chamber, which was large enough to insert his fist. He slipped the canister into the chamber and closed it.
That should do it, Muldoon said. Standard elephant gets about 200 cc's, but they're only 2 or 3 tons each. Tyrannosaurus rex is 8 tons, and a lot meaner. That matters to the dose.
Why?
Animal dose is partly body weight and partly temperament. You shoot the same dose of 709 into an elephant, a hippo, and a rhino, you'd immobilize the elephant so it just stands there like a statue. You'll slow down the hippo so it gets kind of sleepy, but it keeps moving. And the rhino will just get fighting mad. But on the other hand, you chase a rhino for more than 5 minutes in a car and he'll drop dead from adrenaline shock. Strange combination of tough and delicate.
Muldoon drove slowly toward the river, moving closer to the Tyrannosaur.
But those are all mammals. We know a lot about handling mammals because zoos are built around the big mammalian attractions. Lions, tigers, bears, elephants. We know a lot less about reptiles. And nobody knows anything about dinosaurs. The dinosaurs are new animals.
You consider them reptiles? Gennaro said.
No, Muldoon said, shifting gears. Dinosaurs don't fit existing categories.
He swerved to avoid a rock.
Actually, what we find is that dinosaurs were as variable as mammals are today. Some dinos are tame and cute, and some are mean and nasty. Some of them see well, and some of them don't. Some of them are stupid, and some of them are very, very intelligent.
Like the raptors? Gennaro said. Muldoon nodded.
Raptors are smart, very smart. Believe me, all the problems we have so far, he said, are nothing compared with what we'd have if the raptors ever got out of their holding pen.
I think this is as close as we can get to our Rexy. Up ahead, the Tyrannosaur was poking its head through the branches, peering.